Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. April marks Autism Awareness Month, and on today's show, we'll take a look at two separate issues related to this developmental disorder. Later on, we'll talk about autism and creativity with Deborah Hosseini. She's the author of The Art of Autism, Shifting Perceptions. But first, we'll discuss service cuts that will dramatically change the lives of people living with autism in Pennsylvania. Now, I'm not talking about the proposed Pennsylvania budget cuts of, I believe, 20% that are being hotly debated in Harrisburg and elsewhere throughout the state. The budget cuts we're talking about today were originally slated to go into effect January 1st of this year. They were stalled by a lawsuit, and they went into effect yesterday. Joining us in the studio to discuss this issue is WHYY's behavioral health reporter, Mike and Scott. So, Mike, and you've been covering this for a while now, the ins and outs of this. The cuts primarily affected something called community integration services. Explain that.
Community integration services is what's at stake here. And Dan, by law, individuals with intellectual disabilities and autism, especially severe autism, are supposed to be supported in a way that they can live in the least restrictive environment possible. So over the last couple of decades, we've heard a lot about community living, where people are able to live in neighborhoods as opposed to institutions. We've gotten rid of a lot of the institutions that we once had. So now people typically live, let's say, in group homes, or they live supported in their own homes. And community integration services, this is very skilled services. These are people who work with people who have autism. They accompany them, let's say, to their jobs. They go to different events with them, but they are with them a lot, and they continuously observe the behavior, correct behavior, give them feedback, work on certain issues. And with that support, these individuals are able to go about their lives and to work in many cases.
These are highly skilled people, it sounds like.
They are, and that makes these services also more expensive. So typically, an individual who has pretty severe autism usually patches together a network of support through different services. Some are called community integration services, others are behavioral services, all kinds of different services that come from different funding streams. Some come from the federal government, some from the state government. But these community integration services are skilled workers that really can pay attention to an individual's behavior and make sure they don't, you know, a lot of people who have very severe autism, they struggle. They struggle with aggressive behavior. They tend to hurt themselves when they get very upset. They can't regulate their emotions. So these are the kinds of behaviors that really get monitored here.
I recently met Mike and with a mother of an autistic child, a single mother. And the child was pretty high up on the spectrum, and she was talking about all she was trying to do to get services for this child, and she was working. And I said, you need a COO. You need a chief operating officer to run this, but we don't have them. It's really a handful for these parents to deal with, and now this funding is going to get cut.
Yeah, I was just going to say I would like to listen to a piece I did. I visited with families in Phoenixville, and their children who live in Phoenixville are known by their friends and families as the Phoenixville Five. And these parents spend years and years and years setting up a model of care that works for their children, and all of that is at stake now with these service cuts. So let's listen to that piece. Once a week, 39-year-old Alicia Rothman volunteers at a sweet shop located in Valley Forge National Historical Park. She mops the floors and helps clean up. Her boss loves her.
We're very blessed to have Alicia, and next week is our anniversary. How many years you're here?
1, 2, 3, 4.
Store manager Pamela Duell is hugging Alicia as she talks.
9, 10, 11 years.
11 years. So she's like a daughter to me. It's great.
Alicia also has a paying job at Valley Forge Christian College's cafeteria. She enjoys shopping and going out to eat. Wherever she goes, a trained service provider accompanies her. She has one-on-one support all day that enables her to live in a small house that she shares with 41-year-old Becky Leonard, who has autism as well. Back at their house, Becky is playing video games.
Rush, Rush 2!
Becky's parents, Joe and Ginny Leonard, and Alicia's mother, Marcia Rothman, bought the house together over 10 years ago. The Leonards also have a son who has severe autism, Matthew. He's 44. He shares and co-owns a house in Phoenixville with two other men who have autism. The Leonards spent years working their way through a maze of federal and state funding options to patch together a cohesive support system for their son and daughter.
Whether it's vacuuming the floors and making meals, going to the doctor, whether it's going to a job, it's a service that's geared to enabling the person to live in the community successfully and safely.
Before this arrangement, the kids were living at home. After high school, they had nowhere to go and nothing to do. Destructive behaviors flared up, hitting themselves, outbursts, screaming.
What days do you work, Beck?
Monday, Tuesday.
All five adults living in the two houses have flourished, developing steady routines, finding things they enjoy. But Pennsylvania's funding for their support system, so-called community integration services, may be severely cut back within the next few weeks. Under new rules, service hours would be reduced from an as-needed basis to 12 hours a week for only up to 13 weeks. Joe Leonard says the potential cuts threaten his children's way of life and have cast the families into despair.
One of the things that I would say haunts all parents of folks with severe disabilities is their mortality and what's going to happen when I'm no longer around. And a major motivation in creating these homes is so that we can die in peace.
Alicia's mom, Marcia Rothman.
I suffer from anxiety, and it's just worse. I do take medication for it, but Alicia just looms large in my mind.
One option they contemplate is for the kids to come home.
I don't know if I can even go there. She's so different now, so much more mature, mm-hmm. has come such a long way. Mm-hmm. What would happen is she would just revert back to the way she was before she moved here.
Mm-hmm. Our Matthew would be sitting on the couch rocking and banging his head. And Becky, I don't know, up in her room screaming.
Another option might be a group home, which costs the state about the same as paying for the help they get now, about $150,000 a year. But Ginny Leonard says group homes tend not to work for people with autism.
They have a very hard time with sounds and stimuli, and so it's very, very hard for them to cope with environments where there's a lot of people in a room or a lot of people in a house together.
Another option is moving to a psychiatric hospital, which doesn't appeal to the families and would cost the state about $250,000 a year. Several parents have joined a lawsuit filed by the Disability Rights Network to force the Pennsylvania Department of Welfare to revoke the planned service cuts. Kelly Darr is the network's legal director.
We're trying to negotiate with the Department of Public Welfare to make changes to the cuts that they've made in a way that are not so detrimental to the individuals who are going to be affected.
The Department of Welfare will not comment on the cuts because of the pending lawsuit. Frank Unger has joined the lawsuit. His son Michael has shared a house with the Leonard son for over 10 years.
We all know that he's never going to get better, but that he has a life and that he enjoys it and that he can smile now and he's not hospitalized.
Dan, and that not hospitalized, what Mr. Unger just said, that unfortunately we don't know what will happen now because the cuts that I mentioned in this piece have now gone into effect, and we'll hear from Kelly Darr in just a few seconds.
That's really heartbreaking. Let's bring Kelly Dorr on. She's you just heard from Mikan's piece that she's with the Disability Rights Network, who filed that lawsuit on behalf of these families, including the Leonards and the Ungers, to halt these cuts. Kelly, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us, and thanks for the work you do. Listen, if you're just tuning in, we're talking about the impact of these service cuts, these funding cuts, on people in the autism community, especially adults with autism and their aging families. Our number, if you want to join the conversation, is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Kelly, tell us where we stand now. There was a kind of injunction that held off these cuts until April 1st. What happened as of yesterday?
Yeah, so the announcement about these cuts came out in October of 2011, and we filed a lawsuit in early December, a class action on behalf of all of the individuals that would be affected by the cuts. And as a result of that, we were able to have the implementation date of the cuts moved from January 1st for a quarter, and so they went into effect on April 1st. And in that time between January and April, we have been trying to work with the Department of Public Welfare to come to some resolution that will, you know, not have the impact of these cuts be so severe, particularly on the adults who have more significant autism, who are being affected by these cuts. We have made what I hope is a little bit of progress in that regard, in that I think that DPW is taking a less severe look at some of the plans that individuals have, and allowing some folks to continue to have small amounts of community integration services, small numbers of hours during the week, at least in the short term.
As if I'm listening to this as a parent, I don't know what that means.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it is, I have to say, it is, I think, one of the hardest things that's happening right now is that it's very confused in this program about what exactly is going to be permitted and what's not going to be permitted by DPW moving forward. And kind of the cascading effect of that is then the service providers mm-hmm. that provide these services to the individuals, some of whom have been providing programs for, you know, 5, 6, 7, 10 years, are also confused about what the future looks like for these programs. So it is confusing at this point. What I think has happened as far as TPW is they stopped looking at this service as a long-term need that these individuals have, particularly the adults with autism, that they need to have support in the community to be able to live in the successful way that they have over the long haul.
Well, Kelly, just this morning, Mikan got an email from DPW, which I assume is their official statement. Let's hear this email, then we'll take a break, and you'll be able to think about your response to it. Mikan?
Yes, Kelly, I've been emailing the Department of Public Welfare to ask them to participate in our show, which they weren't able to do, but they did send me this statement, and the statement I got reads, "We understand that consumers may be concerned to hear that certain changes were made to the service payment system. However, we want to reassure consumers that these changes do not result in cuts to their needed services. To understand the changes that were made, people must first know that there is an array of services available to the consumer, and each of these services are paid at a different rate. To ensure that providers did not misuse the system by arranging for unneeded or higher cost services, the Department of Public Welfare instituted better oversight and quality control measures. Although certain caps and limits were imposed on the rates, the department retains the discretion to approve payment beyond those caps caps and limits if the person could benefit from those additional services. The department is confident that with the full range of services available, consumers' needs will be satisfied. So again, that was the statement from the Department of Public Welfare.
Kelly, that's an awful lot to react to. So I'm going to let you mull that over for 60 seconds.
Okay, and, sounds good.
And
I'll be ready when we come back.
I have a feeling you will be. We're talking with Kelly Darr. She's the legal director of the Disability Rights Network in Pennsylvania. I'm also joined here in the studio by Mike and Scott, our behavioral health reporter, and our executive producer here on Radio Times. We're talking about the service cuts that are affecting adults with autism and their aging parents. If you want to join our conversation, our number is 888-477-9499. If you're in the community and you're being affected by this, we'd like to hear from you. If you're afraid of being affected by this in the future, give us a call, 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Has your teenager changed friends, and are you feeling uncomfortable about them? Is your teenager skipping school or losing interest in their usual activities, and are you concerned with how they are spending their time? The Family Training Program may be able to help. If eligible, you will be invited to attend individual sessions with a family specialist to help you make positive changes in your life and help improve your relationship with your teen. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2 or www.iamconcerned.org. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
Love me or leave me.
On the next Fresh Air, Doris Day. There's a new CD-DVD set of her recordings and films. She's also the star of the month on TCM, and she's about to turn 88. Also, comic Aziz Ansari. He has a new online comedy special. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
You might find.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. April's Autism Awareness Month, and we are covering it from two perspectives. Later on, we're going to talk about autism and creativity with Deborah Hosseini, but right now we're talking with Kelly Darr, who's a legal director of the Disability Rights Network and has been trying to negotiate with DPW about these pretty dramatic service cuts that are affecting adults with autism and their families. So, Kelly, Mike and read you a letter that she received from DPW, and they were kind of minimizing. What they're saying is that they're going to have better oversight. They said certain caps and limits were imposed on the rates, but that the department retains the discretion to approve payment beyond those caps and limits. So on paper, that sounds not pretty good, yes?
Right. So up until October of 2011, when these proposed cuts were issued, the department always had the discretion to look at the services that individuals were receiving to determine whether it was needed or not. And the idea was those community integration services were available on an individualized basis. So some individuals who are subject to these cuts get smaller numbers of hours of that service, and some get much larger numbers of hours, again, based on their individualized need. What they have done now, and which is still true at this very moment, went into effect yesterday, is they have put an arbitrary cap on those hours that is at the low end of the range. And so as a result, there may be some individuals who were getting lower numbers of hours who, it's kind of too soon to tell on April 2nd whether how it's going to play out, but there may be some individuals, some who don't have autism, some who have milder autism, who will be able to hopefully maintain their services and continue on. Where the huge impact is going to be are on the individuals who Mike has been covering, who have more significant autism, who need a higher level of service in order to live safely and successfully in the community. And it's those individuals, not that we predict are going to be harmed, who are already being harmed. One of the women who Mike and has interviewed and has covered, one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit, has already lost her provider, has lost the home that she was living in, had to return back to her parents' house, and in the time that this has been going on since the cuts have been announced, has already been hospitalized one time because of behaviors that came about when she returned home.
Yeah.
Mike, and how old are her parents?
Her parents are in their 60s. This young woman, Alyssa, is her name, and her parents, the family's name is Anslow. I visited them, and the mother is chronically ill. She has chronic pain, so she has a very hard time. The father is working two jobs in order to provide for the family, and the daughter does have... She does get violent when she is upset. She hurts herself, but she also hurts others. So when I visited them, the parents had completely imagined it kind of like a toddler-proof home. So everything had been put away, every piece of glass, every piece of silverware. There was nothing there. Every picture frame was taken down. They had blocked their front door so that the young woman couldn't go out. And they were very afraid. They said, we don't know. And up until that point, the daughter had not been in the hospital for 4 years.
Mm.
Next time I spoke with the mother, the daughter was in the hospital. She was actually in the ICU because they couldn't find a bed for her anywhere. Never did find a bed for her in a psychiatric unit. So she stayed in the ICU and now she's back home.
And a psychiatric unit probably would not have helped at all, might even have made it worse because of all the stimulations. I don't know whether to ask you, Mike, and you, Kelly, what are the options now for this family and families like this?
I can tell you that the Anslows have been trying to find another provider to come in and provide service for Alyssa, and I don't know what the number is, at least 12 or more providers who they've tried to get to come in without success. I think so. The idea that there are options available, as DPW has implied, for all of these individuals is just not true.
So what are their options? Are there any answers, Mike?
Right now, they have volunteers. They have some people who still come in, but they are not as highly trained. They're not really trained. They are more, excuse the language here, but it's more like you would bring in a babysitter of sorts, somebody to help relieve them. And they also have some volunteers from their church. They are looking everywhere for providers, and this is one of the ongoing issues with these service cuts is that a lot of providers are, in a way, getting out of the game because they don't know, will they get paid, will they not get paid? Some haven't been paid for weeks, so they are losing staff. And this is very, very difficult if you think about the autism numbers that just came out last week.
One in every 88 births.
Yes, and in New Jersey, for example, the numbers were one in 49. So,
and if I...
Yeah, sorry, Kelly.
Sorry, I was just going to bring us back to an earlier point, Mike, and that you made about the cost of these services, and that community integration service is a skilled service and is perhaps more expensive relative to some of the other services that are available under this program that they are participants in. But if you compare it to the alternatives, Dan, you just asked about what alternatives mm-hmm. are out there for these individuals, I think at the end of the day, the alternatives that are available are, state hospitals, state institutions, and things that are much more expensive compared to the community-based programs that these individuals had been living in successfully up to this point. And I think that's, unfortunately, those are the type of alternatives that are out there. These individuals need to be served. They can't not be served. They will get services one way or the other, either in the community, living as independently as they can, or unfortunately in more segregated institutional settings.
I don't know if you heard Mike in's opening comments here, but she referred to by law. She said her language was by law they should live in the least restrictive setting. Kelly, is that law the ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act?
That's correct, and that is in part what our the lawsuit is based on is that law and what's called the integration mandate
well,
of the ADA.
Yeah, in the category of irony, that law was written by Attorney General Dick Thornburgh, who was the governor of Pennsylvania, and Thornburgh was the prime mover of that law. That law existed because of a man who was the governor of Pennsylvania. So that's in the category of irony. Let's go to the phones. We've got Tricia on the line. Tricia, hi. Oh. You're on Voices.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a son who's 21 years old, and he, you know, graduated high school, so now he's out in the adult world here. And he has a personal family-driven waiver. So he attends an adult program from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. And I was just wondering, are these service cuts going to affect the personal family-driven waiver?
Kelly?
I can answer that. These particular cuts will not. These cuts are happening in some of the other waivers, OBRA, Independence, and ComCare. In particular, the lawsuit is about OBRA. And the thing to know, we talk about waivers, which is a kind of a difficult concept that might not be familiar to people who are listening.
You're going to have to explain that, Kelly.
Yeah. These individuals with disabilities are entitled to services under the Medicaid law. And what a waiver program does is allow individuals to be served in the community, in their homes, in the community, as opposed to in institutional settings. So Mike and talked about the trend over the last decades of serving people and allowing people to live in communities in integrated ways. Waiver programs are part of that.
And Dan, so basically, to take us back to the Phoenixville Five for a moment, who we heard about, I think what they are trying to do right now is to hold on to their service providers for now until the situation is a little bit clearer. And then, so they are trying to kind of hold on to the situation as it is now. For example, Mr. Leonard told me that he might start staying nights at the house to provide kind of the overnight shift and all of those different things. They are just trying to hold on until this situation becomes a little bit more clear.
Well, let me interrupt you now because we've got Mr. Leonard on the phone. Joe Leonard? Hello?
Hello.
Joe Leonard, hi.
Yes.
You're on the air with us. Mikan was just talking about you. I don't know if you heard it, but
I did.
About what you're going to do. Tell us your vision of what's going to happen, what your plans are.
Well, our provider has not yet indicated that they are terminating services. And we are looking into the possibility of creating an intermediate care facility, which is a quasi-institutional setting.
What do you mean? What does that look like, Mr. Leonard?
It's a more medicalized residential, 24-hour, 7-day-a-week facility in which people with severe disabilities live, and it means disrupting my kids' lives severely, them losing their homes, the possibility of losing their jobs. But they require this level of care. They are entitled to this level of care for 10, 11 years. They've been receiving this level of care in a less restrictive, less medicalized, truly integrated community setting.
I'll tell you, I can only imagine what this is like for you. You know, the fear and helplessness,
yes.
Anger.
Yes.
Indeed.
Doomsday has approached, certainly have been feeling increasingly anxious and sleepless and, you know, what are we going to do? And we're going through the process to get approval for the creation of a 5-bed intermediate care facility.
Well, I wish you great success, and let's hope Kelly is able to, Kelly and the Disability Rights Network is able to push through something that has more support for you and, frankly, more compassion. Thanks so much for joining in and for being part of this whole process, this whole education for our listeners. Take care. And Mike, and now there's more cuts coming in July 1st.
Yes, Kelly, we only have about a minute left, but there are actually more cuts on the horizon as the Pennsylvania legislature is talking about the upcoming budget, which could mean a lot more cuts for all kinds of different social services. But I think what's also pertinent, you know, if you think about the Leonards and how they navigated this maze of different services and the waivers and the OBRA waiver and this waiver and that waiver, and now they're going to have to do it all over again to probably build a new facility for their care. And this is really a very difficult thing for anybody to understand, you know, let alone a parent who is caring for a child with autism and, in many cases, severe intellectual disabilities, as the Leonards are doing.
And what's heartbreaking about what we heard from Mr. Leonard was, you know, you had this in place for so many years, and now it all falls apart, and the future, once again, is unknown, which is what any family feels when they have a child, a small child with autism. You know, you work for years to get things in place. Mike, and thank you so much. Kelly Dorr, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Really an important issue. Mike and Scott, I appreciate all the research you've done. We'll be back in just 60 short seconds, and we'll be talking about autism and creativity.
Supporting WHYY, HEAL, Holistic Enrichment of Adult Living. HEAL offers health advocacy, companion caregiving, and consultative services to adults with acute and chronic medical conditions. HEAL develops a personalized plan of care for each client. HEAL then provides a quality assurance program to track satisfaction and closely monitor service and outcomes. Their goal is to holistically support an enriched, independent, and healthy lifestyle. Information about HEAL is available online at healconsultants.org.
The singer Morley has traveled the world working with children in conflict zones and performing for people like Nelson Mandela and the Dalai Lama. Her latest and most personal album is called Undivided. We hear new music from Morley next time on Tell Me More.
They stood together under a tree in tall grass on TV.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Our next guest is author Deborah Hosseini. She's a mother of three. Her 17-year-old son, Kevin, is on the autism spectrum and is one of the artists featured in her new book, The Art of Autism, Shifting Perceptions. The book spotlights the work of 77 visual artists and poets on the autism spectrum from around the world. I recently spoke with her about how her son and others connect with art and how the book evolved. Deborah, as you wrote this book, you interviewed a variety of types of artists, both on the spectrum and families of those on the spectrum. I would imagine the impetus for the book came from your son, Kevin?
That's correct. It did. Kevin is on the autism spectrum, and he was diagnosed at age 4, and he was introduced to art at age 9.
Tell us about him.
Kevin had delays in speech, and it wasn't until he was close to 3 years old that we realized that he was really different. And that was when we were at a parent participation preschool, and he wasn't interacting with the other children socially. He'd actually knock over their toys and created all kinds of havoc in the school. And the preschool director, who had a child that had mental retardation, told me that the school wasn't an appropriate placement for Kevin and that he needed more structure and to be in a special environment for kids that are developmentally delayed. Kevin was born in 94, and that was in 1997, and we had not had a diagnosis for him yet. And so after he was put in the special school, we were very fortunate to live close to UCSB, the University of California, Santa Barbara, and they have a renowned autism clinic. We took Kevin there for a diagnosis, and when he was close to age four, he was diagnosed with full-on autism.
Tell us about art. How did that get introduced, and what did it do?
Well, see, that was through UCSB Autism Clinic. They had a clinician by the name of Colin Zimbelman, and Colin had graduated from the art school RISD, and he was studying psychology in his master's program. And Colin came, the first day Colin came to when Kevin was nine, he brought art supplies. And Kevin said, well, draw me a picture. And Colin said, no, you draw me a picture. And from then on, when they would have sessions, it would be around art. And so the first session, Kevin did watercolors. And the second session, he did acrylics. And the third session, Colin brought oils. And Kevin really liked the oil painting, and it was some kind of sensory fulfillment with the dragging the brush and the colors and the mixing. And he was an oil painter for many years, and we just switched him to acrylics a couple years ago because we found out that oils could be kind of toxic, and Kevin was having a hard adolescence, and we felt maybe the toxicity of the oils was contributing to that. So now he paints in acrylics.
What's it like for him? How, when he paints?
Well, Kevin really loves to paint. He needs a person to help facilitate his painting because he has kind of a lack of executive functioning skills, and managing his palette and managing the canvas and everything is difficult for him. But he gets a lot of joy and out of the colors, the shapes. And Kevin is something that's called like a Fauvist painting, where he likes colors and shapes and he likes texture. And he receives a lot of sensory fulfillment out of the texture.
I've seen some of his productions online. They really are extraordinary. They're just beautiful. Have you found, you talk about the joy he receives. Have you found that the painting helps him beyond joy? Does it help with some of his symptoms?
Oh, yeah, it definitely helps to ground him. It's and his sensory issues. It helps with those sensory issues. And it also helps him to focus for a time on something other than what may be going in his mind, because Kevin has sometimes obsessive thoughts about things. Well, when he's painting, he's in that painting realm, and he's concentrating on, the application of the paint to the canvas and the brush strokes and how he's doing that. And it's a really healthy thing for him.
That's really the gift, is to help all of us when we're doing something. It's called flow, optimal human experience, and we are really out of our minds when that's happening. We're just not in our heads. We're in
true.
The experience. Let's come back to the book, Deborah. Tell us who you interviewed and how they got to you, or vice versa.
Well, this is my second Art of Autism book. I was doing art shows for Kevin because he had so many art pieces that we could not contain them in our house. And so I started finding venues for Kevin's art. And when I was doing that, I was kind of, well, this should be more of a community thing. It shouldn't just be about my own child, because there's a lot of artists like Kevin. And so I started hooking up with artists in my local community, in like a tri-county area, and displaying their art along with Kevin's art. Well, that became known to certain people, and the publisher of my first book, Karen Simmons, had written an autism book in 2004, and she wanted another book. And she put me in contact with Dr. Rosa Martinez, who has the Strokes of Genius Art Collaborative, or whatever it is. back on the East Coast, and Rosa was the editor of my first book and put me into contact with so many great savant artists, such as Jonathan Lehrman and Gregory Blackstock, and even Temple Grandin gave me her blueprints for the book. So the first book had 54 artists on the spectrum, and we had essayists as well. This book has 77 artists, and I've added poets because so many people were submitting their poetry, and the poetry, there was some kind of sensory fulfillment, too, with the poetry and the words and how they were using words in a different manner. And some of the artists, you know, are nonverbal, but they write poetry, and it's really a beautiful thing.
You know, Deborah, the entire mental health movement now is shifting from a deficit model to a strength-based model. So apropos of that, you know, you just talked about Temple Grandin. I love your quote in your book by Temple Grandin from her book, The Way I See It. She says, what would happen if the autism gene was eliminated from the gene pool? She says, you would have a bunch of people standing around in a cave chatting and socializing and not getting anything done. And, you know, I love that quote. So, you know, what she's saying is, you know, what we have is not pathology that necessarily needs to be fixed. It needs to be blossomed and further developed.
Yeah, and I think that's what parents need to realize, because myself, I was in this whole pattern of remediation, running around trying. There's so many different therapies you can do with a child with autism. And over the years, we have shifted from remediating deficits to concentrating on Kevin's strengths and also being there with him, you know, slowing myself down, because we're part of each other, kind of. You know, whenever you work with another person, you influence them with your own energy. And so I became more centered as a person, and I kind of would tune into Kevin and what he was doing. And as I centered myself, Kevin would center himself. So I realized I was part of Kevin's issues, because when I was, like, running around trying to do all these different interventions and therapies, I was not as centered as I could be, and that did affect him.
You lose your presence. You get lost.
You lose your presence, yeah. Exactly.
You're listening to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking to Deborah Hosseini. Her book is The Art of Autism, Shifting Perceptions. One of the things we see from your book is that, quote, symptoms can be transformed into art. Tell us about the artist, Grant Manier. Is that
right? Yeah, Grant Manier.
Yeah, and his compulsive behavior. Tell us what he did.
Well, he was a compulsive paper tearer from when he was very young. He had this compulsive habit of tearing paper, and it went away for a few years and came back when he was entering adolescence. Well, his mom Julie said, "Well, you're tearing all this paper." It did not bother her that he tore paper. She instead took the paper tearing and gave him a canvas and told him to paste the paper on the canvas. And from that, he started creating these amazing, it's called eco art, Grant's eco art. And he creates like horses or an image of Texas out of 10,000 pieces or more than 10,000 pieces of recycled cardboard, puzzle pieces, box tops, paper, newspaper, magazines, whatever he could find, he'll put that into his art and create wonderful images. And it gives him some type of, like, focus. He loves to do it, and he's now an advocate and actually speaks out for autism and autism causes, and he sells his work for autism causes.
Have you ever heard of the architect Gaudí from Spain, mostly Barcelona?
No, I haven't.
He's famous. He's an extraordinary architect, and I don't know if he was on the spectrum or not, but he did with tiles what Grant did with paper. Gaudí, whenever he found broken tiles, he would incorporate them in his architecture. He never used a square tile or a rectangular one. If he found one, he would break it.
Oh, that's amazing.
And he did some extraordinary work with those tiles. Back to Grant, though. You know, you mentioned that his mother, Julie, helped him. And how much of this transformation is about the attitude of those people in their environments?
Oh, I think it's a very high percentage about that. And it's about having a parent that is with the child and could help the child find his skills or his or her niche in life, and helps them, you know, manifest their art and their creativity. And it doesn't have to just be through, you know, art in a traditional means. It could be through whatever that child is good at, finding what the child is good at, and that's what you called strength-based.
Yeah.
And then nurturing that. And Julie's a really good example of that. Because a lot of times a parent could give their child some medication maybe to help with the obsessive compulsive, you know, disorder. But she saw that as the tearing as like a comforting thing to Grant. It comforted him, and now he's being comforted by creating these great art pieces that he does.
And having purpose.
And having purpose, yes. Yeah,
that's a critical issue. You know, you talk about parents who believe in their children. You know, something I preach all the time is that our children need our faith more than they need our guidance or our input. They need our faith, and that's what I'm hearing in your stories here, Deborah.
Yes, I think that's so true. In fact, one of my favorite stories about autism is called Faith in the Baby, and it is about a mom's journey through with her child and having faith in that child. And it, what you say is so true. It almost like brings tears to my eyes, because that's exactly what it's about, having faith in your child.
You said that the families who are grown the most are the ones who are able to move through the grief to acceptance of their child for who they are, and also that they have strong belief systems. What do you mean by strong belief systems?
Well, it's kind of funny. When I started composing the book and collecting the stories of families, for example, one of the artists, Neri Avraham, was in Israel, and his mom thought there would be better opportunities for Neri in the United States. So the whole family moved from Israel. They took a big leap of faith and moved to the United States. And that's what I'm calling like a leap of faith. It's faith to create a better future for Neri. And he's like going to college right now and studying art. Another person that did the same thing, a physical journey, was J.A. Tan in Vancouver. And he's just been honored with one of the United Nations Autism Awareness Stamps. It's a really high honor. There's going to be 1 million of those stamps produced, and they're going to be distributed on World Autism Day, April 2nd. Well, he's one of the 8 artists that won. They moved from the Philippines to Vancouver for the same reason, to give J.A. better opportunities. And he graduated from the Emily Carr University of Art in Vancouver, and his art just keeps on changing and growing, and it becomes about the family, you know, the family supporting this one child. It's not just one parent supporting the child, it's the entire family rallies behind the child, and it's a very cohesive, beautiful thing to watch.
And it's also really, it also is about, it's about love, you know, that, you know, the love gets increased and you tend to love more with less expectations, which is the purest form of love.
Yes, definitely.
You know, we've been talking about families, I think, more than anything else here. People on the spectrum, almost by definition, are not so good at verbal communication. I wonder what happens to them and their families when they find their voice through this nonverbal activity.
Well, it's an enlightenment for some. I know that in Australia they use facilitated communication. Well, they use it here in the United States too, but not as much as in Australia. And we have in California a poet, Sidney Edmond, and the mom did not even know that she was really had all these ideas until they started using facilitated communication, and she started creating this wonderful poetry. Well, Louisa Jensen in Australia was the same thing. She started communicating with facilitated communication, and she's now a motivational speaker, but she doesn't speak. She has a website, and I think it's Speaking Without Speech is what it's called.
Hmm.
And she's a motivational speaker, and she goes out and talks about what it is to have autism and not have control over your vocal cords or your speech and what that means to her. And she's submitted poetry for our book, and it was just very revealing. I think it changes the entire family, to answer your question. It just blows you away with what's going on inside themselves.
You know, we're talking about creativity here and nurturing creativity, and what comes to mind here is what's happening in schools and public schools and in this economy. So not only are individualized services being cut back, so are many programs that nurture creativity, art, music, drama. I wonder what that means for our kids on the spectrum.
I don't think it's a good thing. I think families are going to have to, like, take the power back and, you know, whenever they can, introduce their child to different forms of art and whatever, you know, broaden their horizons. And I think that the more the family gets involved with the communities and the art community, the more opportunities will open for their kids and other kids.
So, Deborah Hosseini, I want to thank you so much for taking the time and sharing your experience and your book with us, frankly.
Well, thank you, Dan, for inviting me to be on the show. It's really a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, it's been great fun. Thanks. Deborah Hosseini is the author of The Art of Autism, Shifting Perceptions. Well, that's about it for today's show. Next week on Voices in the Family, some insights into why people snap in acts of violence. Well, you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com, and you can reach our production team at voices@whyy.org. To download today's show or to listen to past shows, go to whyy.org/voices. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our volunteer. And Mark Cernero is our intern. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.